Remember that whole process?
That's right.
Well, people seldom fail to acknowledge, or frequently fail to acknowledge that there's research in journalism.
Great.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Shira Kavan. I'm Senior Librarian at CNN's New York Bureau Library. Welcome to the News Division session this afternoon entitled Keeping Current. Dialogue is our session sponsor this afternoon, and we thank them very much. A bit of truth in advertising here. You would expect that the last problem news librarians would have would be keeping current. But in fact, and I don't think this is a surprise to anyone here, it's all most of us can do to stay on top of what is happening in our own libraries, at our own publications or media outlets, and in our own areas of specialty or expertise. It can be exceedingly difficult to do all of those and keep up with developments in the wider worlds of journalism, librarianship, and information science, too. So, as guides to staying abreast of those developments in all of those other worlds, we present this afternoon's panelists, who comprise a stellar trio, really stellar. We've asked our panel to open their playbooks, an appropriate summertime metaphor here in the shadow of Camden Yards, and tell us how they keep informed and how they inform those already in our profession and students who are about to enter our world of journalism and news librarianship. Our three speakers will give presentations of approximately 20 minutes each, and then we'll open the panel to discussion, questions from the audience. Our panelists this afternoon are Paula Haney, to my left, News Bureau Chief for Information Today, Inc., and editor of Newsbreak for InfoToday.com. In the center, Ira Chinoy, lecturer at the University of Maryland's Philip Merrill College of Journalism and former director of computer-assisted reporting at the Washington Post. And Dr. Abby Goodrum, Velma Rogers Graham, research journalist in new media and technology, and unfortunately suffering from a cold, and an associate professor in the School of Journalism at Canada's Ryerson University. Our first speaker will be Paula Haney. I hope that you brought your dog-eared copies of Super Searchers in the News. Maybe we'll get a little autograph time later. Paula Haney has written and edited books and journals that occupy special places in the news library canon. She edited Database Magazine from 1988 to 1996, has been with Information Today, Inc. since 1996, and now is an editor for InfoToday.com, a regular stop for many librarians on the web. And she is the News Bureau Chief for ITI. In addition, she writes regularly for print and electronic publications. She has edited One Essential Guide to Our Profession, written by two of the best in our business, Marco Williams and News Division Award winner Nora Paul. That book is Great Scouts, Cyber Guides for Subject Searching on the Web. And she has authored The Other, which is her Super Surfers book. Paula has her MLS from Columbia University and a Master's in English from NYU. She'll be sharing strategies for keeping not only herself, but her wide audience of regular readers up to date on developments in the library and information industries. Our second speaker is Ira Chinoy. Ira is a lecturer at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland College Park. His students are fortunate to be learning their craft from a journalist who has earned the highest honor the profession can bestow, the Pulitzer Prize. And he's won it not just once, but twice. He must be doing something right. In 1998, Ira and a team from the Washington Post won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for their report on the use of deadly force by the D.C. police. Earlier in his career, Ira was part of a team at the Providence Journal Bulletin, as a shout out to Linda Henderson for her wonderful paper, that won the 1993, it's her paper now. Get the publisher, it's hers. That won the 1993 Pulitzer for investigative reporting for coverage of corruption and patronage in the Rhode Island courts. Ira has been a frequent speaker at national conferences for reporters, editors, and journalism educators. He has also addressed many international journalists on the finer points of investigated and computer-assisted reporting. He was, this past March, the keynote speaker to the International Visitor Leadership Program sponsored by the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. If he looks familiar to some people in the room, besides Linda, it might be from his lectures at a week-long Poynter Institute seminar for news researchers back in 1995. Ira has his BA in American History and Literature from Harvard, and has recently worked on his dissertation at the Merrill College of Journalism at University of Maryland. Ira's areas of specialty would seem to the layperson to be diametrically opposed. He is an expert in both the 21st century art of computer-assisted reporting and in delving into the pre-computer age treasures to be found at the National Archives. He has found a common thread between the two, the need for careful, empirical research in both the old and new worlds. Our final speaker will be Dr. Abby Goodrum.
Yes, she can speak.
And she can, yes. She is the Velma Rogers Graham Research Chair in News, Media, and Technology and an Associate Professor in the School of Journalism at Canada's Ryerson University. Abby has had the twin pleasures of teaching students in both library and information science and in journalism, and she has done so in both the U.S. and Canada. In 2003, she was acting director of the MS-LIS degree program at Syracuse University. Abby has also been a practicing news librarian, earning her stripes at a place I'm a bit familiar with, CNN. Abby did her stint at CNN's main headquarters in Atlanta, and she and I will be comparing battle scars after the show. Abby has written over 40 chapters, books, and papers. Sure. And she is currently leading a project exploring the social and practice networks of news bloggers. Abby's experience gives her an uncanny ability to bridge the journalist-librarian divide. Or to put it more delicately, she has an ability to fashion the, quote, new model news librarian or new model journalist. When her students enter the news profession, they will be able to look across the reference desk or the city desk and see peers and understand the contribution that each one makes to news gathering. Please welcome them, Paula Haney.
That's a pretty big goal, isn't it? Maintaining sanity? Kind of ambitious of me. I'm going to use PowerPoint slides today, but I have to admit I'm going against the advice of two of my colleagues. Barbara Quint warned me not to join the Borg. And here's what Stephen Cohen, the famous library blogger, had to say about using PowerPoint. Have you ever seen the faces on attendees at presentations where PowerPoint is used? It's like they had their brain matter sucked out by a virtual vacuum. Nothing but empty space to be filled by bullet points and flying words incoming from the top left-hand corner. Okay, so here's the deal. If I see any blank faces, PowerPoint disappears. And I don't have any flying words, at least I hope not. No surprises. They tell me the presentations are going to be on the News Division website with all the URLs, so please don't feel like you have to scribble down what you're seeing. Okay. For information today, I monitor news of the library and information industry. I cover information products and the companies that produce information, as well as the concerns of users of information products, both librarians and end users. I monitor trends, new technologies. I'm responsible for the news coverage on the InfoToday.com website. We do weekly bylined news breaks. I bring in colleagues like Barbara Quint, Mary Diojala, Rich Wiggins, you know, whoever's appropriate, and we do, you know, byline coverage of breaking news in our industry. And we do weekly news digests. The deadlines are a little tough, but to me it's one of the best jobs ever. I also write a monthly column for the print Information Today and do occasional features and reviews. NewsLink is a free weekly email newsletter that we send out, and I do a spotlight article for that. And then these are some of the pubs that ITI publishes. and I do weekly alerts and ongoing alerts to all the IT editors and company execs. And finally, I write the news resources column for Cyber Skeptics Guide. Here's what I see as the challenges. We're dealing, obviously, with 24-hour news cycles these days, fueled by everyone's seemingly insatiable appetite for current news. And this affects both producers and users of news. The way we read and find out news has completely changed over the last several years, pretty obvious. There's pressure to get the scoop. And again, this affects both producers and users of information. The competition is fierce in the news business when you get that story out. But I'd warn you, not be careful, not all coverage of breaking news, especially blogs, get it right from the get-go. Maybe first, but not always right. Sometimes a little more time can provide current perspective and accurate reporting. Barbara Quint and I sometimes worry that people will see or pass up reading an article because they'll say, oh, I read about that. I saw it on, you know, six places, and I read the press release and da-da-da. But in fact, you know, an article that's got a little more time and maybe a little more perspective can provide additional details, assessments, that sort of thing. And obviously the openness and immediacy of the web can force a trade-off with quality of information. Search expert Rita Vine complains about too much noise. And she calls restatements of press releases, she calls them marketing lies. So we often don't get enough analysis. So the challenge is sifting through the noise and distractions, get to the solid content. We all have pressures to stay connected, you know, at the expense of our free time and sanity and family involvement. And information overload. No explanation needed there. So, I like to play tennis. That's my physical and mental therapy. And I'm often facing opponents that are younger and faster than me. So, when I'm on the court, I just keep focusing on my three P's, which is planning, patience, and placement. And, you know, when it's a tough match, persistence. So how I approach tennis is sort of how I approach my work. And I tried to make a tidy list of P's, but it didn't work. So anyway, here's my theories of keeping current. Let someone else gather it for you. But be sure that you target top minds and sources. Go for quality. We're awash in sources of news and information. We need high-quality, filtered coverage to make the best use of our times. Have information pushed to you. If you can sign up for an RSS feed, it means less junk dropping into your inbox that has to be shuffled and deleted and whatever. Scan for the nuggets. When you get RSS feeds, you learn to scan quickly. You've got a lot to look through. You can dip through some of those things real fast. Try to be efficient and, you know, move it along. Network with others. Leverage those professional connections. And you're doing that. You're here. And then cast a wide net. And I'll show you how I put those theories into real strategies. I mentioned using an RSS reader. I happen to use blog lines, but, you know, there's a number of very useful ones. Cuts down on your email clutter. Watch for the little RSS button on your favorite site. The big thing is there's just an amazing array of content types available for feeding into your reader. Everything from trade articles to e-journal contents, blog updates, even Edgar filings and Supreme Court arguments. You can have all that dropped in, organized in your feed reader, and then you're not cluttering your email. Keep feeds to a manageable number. I try to do my add one, drop one rule, but I'm not always successful. I have about 70 that I keep in my blog lines that I, you know, read and scan. And, you know, people like Stephen Abram, he has many more, but I think he's a speed reader. He does everything speedy, so. And then it's important to constantly reevaluate your sources and purge relentlessly. You're not finding good stuff in this particular feed, drop it. It's out of there. And then try and reduce redundant information. If you're starting to see similar things popping up in the same, figure out which one you can drop. But learning to scan quickly. A great source for topical feeds is Moreover. The first thing there lets you choose feeds from pre-built topical categories and even create your own feed with a keyword search. I get a good 6 or 7 different feeds. They have top internet stories, online content, online search engine news. You know, those all come courtesy free from Moreover. Now, the Moreover feeds are for individual non-commercial use, and you know, there's some ads and stuff in there. They do have corporate solutions, which cover more sources, offer more enhanced metadata, more flexibility, functionality, et cetera. And they, you know, they license that into corporate settings. But for, you know, for free, go for the individual feeds. This is the page, and there's a little pull down, and you can click on categories, subcategories. There's a little box to do the search feed. It's very cool. Some recommended e-newsletters, and again, some of these are available via RSS, so again, you don't have to have them dropping into your newsletter, your inbox. If some of you came in late, you might not have heard. This is all going to be posted on the website, so you don't have to write those long URLs out. Okay, some of the ones that we do. I mentioned ITI NewsLink. It's weekly on Monday. E-Content Magazine has a very excellent newsletter. Good coverage of current news, comes out twice a week. EduPage is a free newsletter. It summarizes developments in information technology. It's from EduCause, and you know, most of their things do focus on higher ed, but this particular EduPage offers a more general synopsis and pulls some really good things from mainstream media, an excellent abstracting source. Recommend it. Search Day from Chris Sherman, the search expert. I always read that one. Even if on days when I don't have time for everything, I manage to fit in Search Day. And Jeannie Taberski does TBC Alert. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's a very popular speaker at conferences. Excellent. She just, it's not just for legal, it's professionals of all sorts. LJ has an LJ Express free newsletter, and they have a couple others that are available. Also very good for keeping up. Resource Shelf, Gary Price. Does anybody here not read Resource Shelf? I mean, it's definitely one of those important ones. He has people like Shirley Kennedy and Stephen Cohen working with him on it, so he's not completely doing it himself. Couple of others, Librarians Internet Index. Scout Report's been going since something like 1994. And Mary Lane Block does a nice job of covering free sites of substantial reference value. Every issue, I pick up a couple of things. Okay. Industry Analysts. There's two firms that cover the industry. Both put out some good stuff. John Blossom of Shore Communications. Excellent stuff. Good commentary on his blog, analysis of the industry. A lot of the outsell stuff you have to pay for, but there is some good stuff on their site as well. Sign up for alerts. You know, whether it's a Google or whether it's one of your professional services. Don't forget about those. Pick out some key areas that you want to keep up in, and let them let you know. Some key library blogs that you might want to check. Yeah, you kind of have to be careful. You can get carried away monitoring too many blogs, too many sources. But there's a few. Of course, the news, is it NewsLib? NewsLib blog? NewsLib blog? I don't know. Anyway, if you haven't checked it, it says, news researcher, news librarians and researchers collaborating to improve information gathering. So that's a good one. Steve Cohen, Mary Diocala, the Info Today blog. We usually use it for covering conferences, and we are blogging this event. There's 5 ITI editors here, and we're all madly going back to our rooms and blogging. How am I doing? A few more library blogs that you might want to know about, and again, these will be posted. Tame the Web, LIS News. Peter Scott's library blog is now sponsored by XRefer. And there's a list at the Internet Public Library that you can check for more. Okay. Some discussion lists. There's a couple. BizLib, NewsLib, LibLicense. Oh, LibLicense. This is comes out of an academic setting. I believe it's out of Yale. But it actually covers issues that are pretty broad related to licensing. So if you have any licensing issues, I mean, you can licensing resource links, licensing terms and descriptions. I mean, you know, this is a good, helpful site. And it could be of use for corporate and special librarians. Sign up for product news and read it from the vendors. They're pretty good about doing good quality stuff, and we shouldn't forget to take a look at it. And then, of course, you can use something like a web watcher, page watcher tool. Gary Price is a huge believer in this. Every speech I think I've heard him say, he talks about this. His favorite, I think, is Website Watcher, which is a downloadable software thing. I haven't quite gotten into that, but I think that's probably my next stage, is to use one of those tools. Some additional resources. Take advantage of webcasts for new products and technologies. There's an increasing number of these available. Vendors are doing them. Companies are doing them. I got on one or two lately and found it very helpful to, in a short time, just totally get up to speed and then know what questions I wanted to ask about a product. They're also offered by SLA, OCLC, many other groups are doing webcasts in all sorts of interesting areas. Take time to read up on new technologies. Save some after-hours reading time for journals, Online Searcher, whatever, Information World Review, Information Outlook. Target key sessions at key conferences, as you're doing here. Recharge yourself. Other good ones are Internet Librarian, Computers and Libraries, local chapter and division meetings. Another really good way to keep up. To complement your information gathering, use some of these productivity tools. I happen to use Copernic Desktop Search to help me find what I've previously stored on that somewhere in there. If you see something and it triggers, I need to go back and see what I learned about that before. Save your previous work using some of these other tools. Mary Ellen Bates in one newsletter wrote, "What is particularly noteworthy about the information profession is the increased importance in managing information rather than simply finding and delivering it to others. As we rely more heavily on web-based resources, the need for information organization and information sharing tools become that much more critical." And these are some examples of some good stuff for doing that. And my final word, take a break. And this is what I like. My favorite place. And there's my contact information, and please let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.
I'm doing this the old-fashioned way with show and tell. I have a question for you all. In my new life as a teacher for the last 5 years, I've decided that's the way to start anything. But I'm just curious how many of you work in news organizations. Just show hands. Most of the room. Okay. How many of you have worked with journalists and sort of teamed up with journalists to go into archives to find news in archives? A few. And how many of you would consider yourselves practitioners of the part of computer-assisted reporting that involves not sort of going on the web, but working with sort of databases in something like Access or SQL Server or Excel? A few. Okay. So I think what I'm going to do today is, because it's a pretty mixed group, and I want to keep an eye on the time here. Is for those of you who are already familiar with some of this, I hope I'll give you some ideas, some additional ideas. And for those of you who aren't, I hope I will give you some new ideas. As Shira said, I'm talking about things that are on pretty far distant ends, seemingly, of the spectrum of information, one being computer-assisted reporting, which is over here in the, you know, in the modern information age, working with databases, and the other is over here working with archives. And my archives friends sometimes get mad at me when I say getting dusty in the archives, but, you know, you do. But there's a connection between them in my mind. And when I think about teaching students and I think about talking to journalists, and especially young journalists, and I think a lot of what I hope you all do is kind of bring young journalists along, teach them. I know that's sort of, you know, as adding keywords to databases and things like that tends to go away, I think there's a sort of a rising teaching function for news librarians, I hope, if your news library isn't being killed off completely. And I think what these have in common in my mind is that we need to teach journalists to, you know, to be empirical. And that's what these have in common. And this is a leap, certainly, for students, the idea of getting beyond kind of, you know, the formulaic he said, she said, but when somebody says something, to say, well, to ask them, well, how do you know that? And then to go a little further and say, well, I'd like to see it for myself. And then maybe go even a little further and dig stuff up before anyone else gets it. So my presentation is a little different from Paula's. Paula gave you these great tools and resources, and I wrote about half a dozen of them down. They're wonderful. I can't wait to go back and check them out. In a sense, I'm sort of saying what's old is always new to people who are new to the business. And this idea of being empirical is very, very, very important. I will share, I want to, and what I did is I brought just a stack of show and tell, and I'll go through as much of it as I can in 15 minutes here to show you examples of the ways that journalists are using tools. Some of them classic, some of them quite new. But I do, I realized while I was sitting here that I can share with you one resource that I would urge you to get. How many people here are subscribers to Uplink? Good. Okay. A few. I like that. And how about the IRE Journal? More. Okay. So I would urge everyone to become a member of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and you get this fabulous, you know, journal on investigative reporting where people come and do a sort of postmortems on their projects, and you learn so much from these. And then Uplink is specifically for computer-assisted reporting. It's, I don't know, I think it's now about $40 a year. It's extra. It's well worth it. People talk about the kinds of resources that are available, the databases you can get, and this combination of kind of gold mines and landmines. And anyone who's worked on the database knows that not only is the database no good without the documentation, but it's much better if you can sort of talk to someone who's worked with the database before and knows kind of where the landmines are, you know, what kind of trouble you can run into. And I'm actually going to talk about some stories that are here in one of these issues. The other thing I just want to mention briefly is that, you know, there's a price of entry to using both of these tools. And computer-assisted reporting, the kind of obvious price of entry, I suppose, is it's learning how to use a tool like Microsoft Access and Microsoft Excel, and there's kind of a next price of entry, which is maybe learning how to go on the web and find something like the toxic release inventory databases that are on the web that people can analyze in their own communities. But underneath that is a sort of the real price of entry, and it's what you do when somebody says no. Okay. And I have discovered in the last 5 years as a teacher that the biggest part of what I have to teach is a project in which students have to go out and try to get databases from real human beings in government agencies. And the classic first answer from almost all of those except the extremely enlightened, and there are some of those, and they're wonderful, and we embrace them wholeheartedly, but the first and second and third and fourth and fifth answer is no. No, we don't have it. No, I don't know what you're talking about. No, you can't have it. No, it's got private information, so you can't have it. Okay, we can give you the public information out of the private information, but we're not going to give it to you electronically. Back up your truck, because we're just going to give it to you on paper. So these are all things that I think there's a constant learning process. And the thing that I would just kind of show hands, in the state where you work, how many of you consider yourself highly knowledgeable about the state version of FOIA in your state? In Maryland, it's called the Public Information Act. Okay, I would urge everyone in the room, when you go home, the stuff's on the web, and actually I'll give you a web address, jclass, J-C-L-A-S-S, umd.edu/CARS. And there I've got a link to sort of my syllabi and to special presentations. And one of those special presentations was one on access to government records. And there's a place where you can go and sort of look for your state and find the state law for your state. It's really, really important. And if you're not using that law, my guess is that your newsroom may not be using that law effectively. Everyone ought to be using it all the time. And you could be a leader in your news organization in pushing to get these records and pushing past them now. Okay. Well, what I want to do now is just show you some examples. And I apologize to those of you who are already pretty knowledgeable about this. Some of them are old classics, and some of them are newer. The first one I want to talk about is one that was done actually in the 80s at the Providence Journal. And I have Linda to thank for digging this up for me, because I couldn't find it 5 years ago, I think, when I went looking for it. The text of it somehow was missing from the online database. And she found it and sent it to me. Thank you, Linda, because I use this in every class. And the goal in computer-assisted reporting, the thing that people ought to really always be looking for, is to use records in ways that the makers of the records never envisioned that they'd be used. That's the goal. That's where the payoff is. And I really sort of push people to kind of try to think outside the box. That's the home run. And in this case, this was a situation where there had been three separate fatalities of school children who died in school bus accidents, hit by school buses. And while a lot of people were off sort of looking at safety equipment, some reporters at the Providence Journal and a news librarian turned systems IT person for the paper teamed up and got essentially a couple databases, worked off a couple databases. One was the list of school bus drivers in the state, and the other was the traffic court database. And actually, there was a third, which was the criminal court database. And the goal in that story was where those databases intersected. And so I'm just going to read you the top of the story. And again, my hope is to kind of inspire you with some examples of stories that kind of go out and maybe push for more of this where you are. It says, Rhode Island system fails to fully check driving records of bus applicants, traffic violators, some felons certified to drive school buses. Speeding, operating without evidence of registration, operating without a license, operating an unregistered motor vehicle, operating without evidence of registration, no license on person, speeding, running a red light. It has a name of a person here. I know this is going to be a podcast, so I'm going to leave that out. So-and-so amassed these 12 violations between October 1979 and March 1985. 2 weeks ago, while driving a school bus, he was charged with two more, driving without eyeglasses, failure to take adequate care, and starting from a stop. He was charged after he struck a 16-year-old girl who had just stepped from his bus in Warwick. Her leg and two fingers are broken. As of last Tuesday, he is still certified to drive a school bus. As bad as his record is, it is far better than that of some drivers the state has certified to carry school children. So this is a case where being empirical gets beyond what the reporters encountered every place they went, where people says, oh, our bus drivers are the safest in the state. We check everybody's records. And when you have access to this sort of empirical base, you can go in informed and you can tell a different kind of a story. Another kind of goal here was in another sort of classic story in East St. Louis, which I guess has a bit of a... Anyone here from St. Louis? I guess East St. Louis has a bit of a reputation as having kind of cantankerous politics. You may be familiar with the story. Was that?
Well-deserved.
Yeah, well-deserved, right. So this was a situation which the St. Louis Post-Dispatch we're looking into sort of all kinds of voter fraud, and what they did is they got the voter registration list. They had some problems getting this stuff computerized, and actually at some point built some databases from paper records. But voter registration list and the death index, which they got from one of the states, and they looked for those where those two databases intersected. And this is the story they did. It's headline: Dead or Alive. Cities and eligible voters number in the thousands. Here's the lead. A man named Admiral Wary, an Army veteran who owned a barbecue pit and a tire repair shop in East St. Louis, died more than 2 years ago. But that didn't stop him from voting in the Illinois Democratic primary on March 20th. Wary was one of at least five dead people in East St. Louis whose names were on the list of voters casting ballots. And so, you know, it's a kind of a really clever story. They also got a database, the tax assessor's database, and they took vacant properties, addresses of vacant properties, and addresses from which people had voted and put them together and got two stories. They did what we try to teach journalists to do, was also kind of check it out. Never take anything in database at face value. Treat it like anything else. And they drove to these properties and found two things. One is some of them were really vacant, and like 28 people were registered to vote from some, you know, vacant property. But the other was there were houses that had been on these vacant properties for 20 years paying essentially no property tax because the house was listed. So, you know, these are kind of classic stories. They don't all have to be. So I'm going to run through a bunch of examples now. Will you let me know when I have like 5 minutes left? Okay. Just a bunch of examples to give you an idea. They don't all have to be gotchas. One of my students was working at the Baltimore Sun right down the road. While she was taking the class, and someone there got a database of pet registrations. And so she did the pet name story. You know, it's a great, you know, a new breed of pet names. And it's a wonderful story. They don't have to be gotchas. They can be really interesting things. This story had the best, sort of the most popular dog and cat names listed, you know, which you could do with a database. But it also had things like, you know, some Howard County dogs, for example, are called Starbuck, Cosmo, Kramer, Corona, and Puff Daddy. Cats share names like Sinbad, Pearl Jeb, and Orphan Annie. And it just kind of went out and found these people and did this great feature about what's going on in the community. They don't have to be gotchas, but they can sort of give you things you can't get in any other way. One of my students, actually, one of the few who actually succeeded in getting a database on his first attempt to get it, got the database of elevator inspections in Maryland. And he came back and he was a little disappointed because all it had was each elevator, the building it was in, and the date it had been inspected. And we sort of brainstormed it in class and decided, well, you know, there's enough there, actually. And we talked about the dates and had him go back and do some research and look at the law, you know, and kind of teach them that you don't have to assume things ought to be inspected with a certain frequency. There's a law, there's a regulation, there's a rule that's something that you can compare what you have to this other thing. And for those of you doing computer-assisted reporting or working with databases, this question of compared to what, which I picked up from one of my colleagues at the Washington Post, and I hammer my students with it, is one of these sort of great heuristics that you can apply when you're working with databases. And so he got this story. Nearly a quarter of the elevators in Maryland are chronically under-inspected, and in some counties that number nears 50%, according to analysis of the state's elevator inspection database. So, you know, it's kind of a simple story. You could take the story and you could get the database of accidents, elevator accidents, and you could marry them up and kind of have a pretty interesting story. I like to show this to my students. It's a Reader's Digest. And you think, man, this is about the last place that I'm going to find. I asked them if they aspire to be in Reader's Digest. They said, oh, no. And I said, well, you should, you know, because first of all, they pay you for work you've already done. They give your employer the same amount of money. And your Aunt Rose is going to see it on the checkout line, you know, so do it. And this is one about fatal hospital mistakes. And it turns out there are databases state to state of hospital outcomes. You can't get people's names, obviously, but that somebody checked in and never checked out, and that they died of a staph infection, you will find in these databases. So this reporter from Chicago Tribune, Mike Behrens, who's done just wonderful work over the years, wrote this story, Deathbeds. Dirty hospitals kill 75,000 patients a year. You know, a very important story. Lacey Peterson is another one, right? So Lacey Peterson, we had all these kind of the pack following Scott Peterson around. Somebody at the Washington Post got the idea to do a story about whether these weren't sort of one-off events, but whether it was a pattern, and ended up with this story. Many new or expectant mothers die violent deaths. These killings produced only a few headlines, but across the country in the past decade, hundreds of pregnant women and new mothers have been slain. Even as Scott Peterson's trial became public fascination, little was said about how often it happens, why, and whether it was a fluke or social syndrome. And this is a story that relied, I think, on, among other things, on studies. But one of them was that, I'm not going to find it here, that this was sort of this is a leading cause of death, homicide, leading cause of death for women of childbearing age or recently given birth. Well, let me move on to archives because I'm redo one more of these. This is a story that Providence Journal did. I'm stumbling across them. These are not stories that I did. But this is one on lead poisoning, and these reporters got two sets of databases. One was at the individual level, you know, all children up around the age of six have to be tested, and they got that database without names. And then they later got the database of inspections for lead poisoning in houses. And this is the lead into that project, the reprint of that project. Imagine what would happen if a toxic substance rained down on Rhode Island and poisoned nearly 3,000 children in a single year. Alarms would go off at the State House. Community protests would erupt. Hearing rooms would be packed with anxious parents. The fact is, year after year, thousands of children are poisoned here by lead paint wearing off older houses. But there's no groundswell of outrage, and most people seem unaware that lead is even a problem. Okay, so, you know, and this was, somebody got the bright idea to look at these databases and to marry them up. And then they did some rather interesting work looking at, you know, they did one story about a two-year-old who died from eating paint chips and found out that, in fact, in her, did a map, sort of, they mapped this, and in her neighborhood there was a ton of this stuff. Other kinds of stories people are doing. The Houston paper set out several dozen sensors at people's homes around a refinery and then cooperated with the local school of public health and did a sort of really amazing story about this intense pollution in this neighborhood that wasn't being picked up by the state. So there's journalists sort of going out using a new tool, sensors. A paper in Florida used satellite imagery to test out this assertion that, you know, wetlands weren't being destroyed in Florida, and found, you know, in fact that they were being destroyed. This reporter took two courses and learned how to read these things and got two series over time. The Dallas paper got school test scores and found strange sort of patterns by comparing groups of children that had taken the same test at the same school like a year apart, and found that in the test that counted for whether the state got to be declared, you know, a good school, the students were outliers at one end, and in the other end they were not, and sort of did this, found the schools that were outliers in one way and terrible in another, went to the schools and got people to admit there had been rampant cheating on the part of educators. This is sort of stuff that's going on now. Okay, archives, very quickly. So the notion of history as news is a little odd, you know, frankly. But more and more journalists are finding occasions to do stories out of archives. And here's just a quick list of ways that archives can be news. One is fleshing out hidden history as context for current events. So when George Bush, the current, announced that they were going to try people seized in Afghanistan by military tribunal, and somebody mentioned that this hadn't been done since the Second World War, several enterprising journalists all converged at the National Archives and found the records of, here it's called the Keystone Commandos, but a group of eight Nazi saboteurs who landed in the U.S. in 1942 and were eventually caught. They were sort of German-Americans who'd come back. Their heart wasn't really in it. One of the leaders actually kind of turned them in. They were tried by tribunal. Six of them were executed. What the 3,000 pages of records in the archives showed, well, debriefing of these people, was sort of what had gone on behind the scenes and how the FBI had sort of tried to take some more credit for this than they actually deserved, that they had urged some of these people to kind of keep quiet, and, you know, with the leader, and he'd be kind of taken care of in the end. Revealing and resolving lingering injustice, there have been a number of stories that have come out of archives about the Holocaust and World War II, and sort of this revelation that, as Greg Bradshaw of the National Archives says, that World War II was not only, you know, the Nazis sort of not only perpetrated the greatest murder in history, but also the greatest robbery in history, and have, you know, so they, because of stuff that's come out of the archives, the Swiss banks have ponied up well over $1 billion now in reparations for accounts that they essentially denied that they had. Insurance companies, there have been stories about insurance companies that never paid out policies. Some reporters have gone in the archives and done stories about American corporations, major American corporations that profited from their German subsidiaries during the war or employed slave labor. Some of these are court cases now. Fine. A couple more here. Surprising us with the history of current public figures, you know, Bob Woodward is fond of saying that the Watergate tapes are the gift that keeps on giving. And I'm sure there are people in, you know, there's a lot of them that still have not been, they sort of dribbled out a little bit each year. And all kinds of people have been embarrassed by what has come out of those archives about sort of what they, you know, they're and kind of agreeing with Nixon as he was ranting about Jews and women and blacks and Hispanics. Doesn't make some people look particularly good. Marking anniversaries, you know, we can all do that, whatever community we're in. Go back 40, 50, 100 years. I get something called newspaperarchive.com's daily, sort of a daily email. Does anyone get that?
Anyone?
Okay. It's a really, you know, you've got the ProQuest historical databases, which are like unbelievably fabulous, where you can go in and sort of do keyword searching. But newspaperarchive.com has taken a lot of smaller papers. I think it might serve the genealogical community. I'm not completely sure. A lot of smaller papers and some pages from each of these papers. And you can find pretty neat stuff that happened in the smaller places away from the big cities that are home to the papers that's in ProQuest. But they send out, I get a daily email about what happened this date in history. It could be a great takeoff for stories if you can be a little ahead of it. And there's a site, and I think it's timelines.com. It's on one of the links on my site where you can go, you know, I have my students go in and look back 50 or 100 years to what's coming up in the next year, that if they sort of hop on it and do a little research, they could be ahead of the game and do a pretty neat story. And one of my students was interested in the March on Washington and found some pretty neat stuff about military preparations for the March on Washington and stuff that sort of hadn't entered the, you know, really the literature on this. And she found herself working at USA Today that summer when they were sort of gearing up to do this retrospective. And she said, well, you know something about this. And they did a story about this, you know, sort of this going back 40 years and looking at the military. I think I'm probably out of time. So I'll entertain, you know, questions later on.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm plugged in. Thanks. Hi. No, I'm good. First of all, I want to apologize to my my fellow panelists for my coughing fit, and I'm hoping that I'll get through this presentation without evolving into another one. I'm Abby Gooderman. I'm really pleased to be here. This, for me, is the first time to be at SLA with my new hat on. I used to come regularly as a member of SLA. In fact, I got my start in SLA when I was a master's student in library science at the University of Texas at Austin. And in fact, I won one of those, you know, student scholarships. I think it was the advertising and marketing division awarded that to me, and I was never more pleased in my life. So this has always been, for me, like family, although, gosh, it's gotten big. But today I'm speaking to you with a different hat on. I'm speaking to you as an educator in a school of journalism. And so just briefly, what I want to do today in my 20 minutes is give you a little context for the perspective that I want to share with you today. I want to talk about the similarities and gaps between what librarians and journalists do, and most of you already know this, but I'm looking at it from a new pair of eyes because I've long educated library students. In fact, I was a director of the library science program for a year at Syracuse. Now I'm educating journalism students, undergraduates, in Toronto. And one of the, I don't know why this surprised me as much as it did, having been a librarian at CNN, but it surprised me to learn how very similar we are. So I want to talk about the similarities, but the gaps are telling too. And at the end, I'll talk to you a little bit about how you could keep current, but I'm not going to be able to give you the wonderful wealth of resources that Paul has shared with you. I want to talk about it more from a process standpoint than from a resource standpoint. And in between there, I'm going to talk about authority, because I think that that's our biggest challenge. It's our grand challenge today. And not just for librarians, but for journalists.
Okay, so as you already know, Shara told you, I came out of radio, television, and film, couldn't get a job, went to library school, did that, went to CNN, because what do you do if you have a film degree, video production degree, and a library degree. I love that Kathy Christensen, I don't think she's here right now, but she encouraged me every few weeks. I'd say, Kathy, I've got a great research idea. Have we ever looked at all the query logs to see how people really ask for things? And she finally took me aside one day and said, you know, you really need to be in a doctoral program where somebody will actually pay you to ask those questions. And so, in fact, I took her advice, and I went to North Texas where I majored in information science. I left there. I went to Drexel. I was on faculty at Drexel for 4 years before Ray Vondran at Syracuse made me an offer I couldn't resist. Was there, acted as a director for a year, and then had an incredible opportunity to move to Canada. And in fact, those of you who heard that my move coincided with my Patriot Act study, I just want to reassure you that I was not run out of the country. I can return. I am here. No one has stopped me at customs so far. It was just one of those things. No, really. Okay, so what we do, and I put we in quotations here because by we I mean librarians and I mean journalists. We do some very similar kinds of things. And in fact, if you look at our pay scales, we're motivated by some of the same kinds of altruistic desires to be helpful, to be know-it-alls, to be, you know, the go-to people on any topic, to be jacks of all trades and masters of none. We have some really similar sociological makeup, and there's probably a 12-step program for us. What we do? Well, we find information and sources for information, which is not always easy to do. We evaluate that for accuracy and validity. I want to focus on that a little bit more later. We gather information together from very diverse sources and formats. And as Paula highlighted, 24/7, right? So it's got to happen fast and it's got to be entertaining, right? So I want to talk about that when we talk about accuracy and validity and diverse sources and formats. We uncover patterns and we find meanings. And that's so clear from our last speaker, Ira. That was absolutely, you know, in my next life, I want to be an investigative reporter. And we provide analysis and summarization. Librarians do this. How many of you, when you started your career as librarians, actually gave a client a list of citations? Yeah? And you learned quickly, right? They handed it back to you. So we do the value-added analysis and summarization. Well, guess what? So do journalists. You know, they don't publish all of the notes they take. There's a whole lot of really rich information that never makes it in because they're trying to tell a story, and they're trying to tell that story in a flexible way that's appropriate to the audience they're trying to reach. And a study I'm doing right now looks at hybrid bloggers or J-bloggers. So these are bloggers who are hired by mainstream media, and in fact, most of them are columnists in Canada or mainstream media like Maclean's and the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail. And they'll tell the same story in two very different ways, one for their column and one for their blog. So, so being flexible. And you know how to do that, too. You might be asked to get the same kinds of stats, but in one case it's for the financial news division or it's for a financial report. Another case it's a human interest story. And you know that you summarize that information differently. All right, just before we launch into what I think is sort of the grand challenge facing us today, I want to give some context for where we all came from. All of you here have library science degrees, maybe, or you went to library. Not everybody, but increasing numbers. Any of you also, show of hands, the sort of boundary spanners, journalism degree and library science degree. Woohoo! Yeah, yeah. Okay. We are seeing programs in the United States and in Canada that are blending, but in most cases it's not because people recognize that there's a disciplinary common ground. In most cases where you find schools of journalism and schools of library and information science merging, it's because of socioeconomic political reasons at the university so that people don't get shut down so you can, you know, pool your resources. There's not a lot of understanding, there's not nearly enough understanding of our common ground. And those of you who have 2 degrees know there's a common ground. So both LIS and journalism in schools, as they're taught in education, are wrestling with the balance between theory and practice. Right? My students want to know how to do CAR today. They want to know how to find the single best source for information on the Iraq War today. What they don't want to know is sort of the higher level meta-theoretical approach to sort of thinking about how you critically read and review and summarize and synthesize. That's a little harder test. Well, guess what? Don't feel smug. Library science students, exactly the same thing. How do I catalog? Not how do I think about representation across formats, across audiences, forever and ever. There was rumors of the death of library science when Google came about, a little premature. Similarly, blogging has not killed journalism off. But there's always this sort of fear. And it's an odd sort of psychological place that we find ourselves in, that we seem to think that the next technological revolution is going to put us out of business. We know that's not true. We add value to what we do as librarians, and journalists add value to information dissemination that cannot be gotten any other way. We know that if you went to library school, you were lucky if you got a news librarianship course. Not many of those exist, and where they are, they're a very small part of curriculum. Maybe they're not even offered every year. Similarly, if you got a school of journalism or a degree program in journalism, they'll offer an access sort of retrieval. It'll be like a resources course, usually in the first year before the students can really use it. It doesn't take hold. It's almost as useful as teaching. What do we used to call it? In the old days in libraries, bibliographic instruction, right? So it's the same. A lot of times, it's the same kind of course. In some of the journalism programs that are a little more provincial in Canada, they're still taught by a librarian in a one-week sort of tutorial. So they're next to useless. In the better journalism schools, there's more emphasis put on retrieval, but you're still not turning out people who want to go and be reference librarians, right? So it's a little different approach. In our reference courses today in library school, we are still focusing primarily on published material. And publishing can be widely construed, but there's not a lot that goes on in library science curricula for reference that focuses on things like how to search for images and videos, how to search for non-textual material and maps. It might be like a one-week unit, if that. And the same is often true in journalism schools, whose resources, they're not just published resources. Like, resources for information in journalism are going to be Freedom of Information Act databases, interviews, stats, images, all kinds of computer-assisted database reporting tools. Interviewing in both is an absolutely crucial skill. We teach a course in interviewing in the School of Journalism. In my experience in library science, it was always maybe a week or two taught along with reference. And it's absolutely crucial for both groups of people. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting, unique things, and you guys know this, in library science, you do the search for the journalist, you're the librarian, and you don't find anything. Darn. The journalist, you didn't find anything? All right. I'm the first one to report on this. And when we think about authority, we were all taught that one of the ways that you evaluate the resources that you recommend to your clients is authority, right? That's one of those critical key attributes of some document. And authority is, who wrote this? What's their claim to fame? Or who said this? Why are they an expert? Who makes them an expert, right? And we have a number of ways we do that. But when you're on deadline 24/7 and guest bookings calls down and says, we've got 24 hours to replace a guest, so we need an expert on public versus private adoptions, right? You are probably going to do a search. Who wrote or published or said something about private adoptions? It's going to be just that fast. In journalism, it's the same thing. They want, you want to quote an expert, you want to interview an expert, particularly somebody who, can speak. If it's broadcast, they need to be eloquent and, say no. So, you want someone who can actually go on camera or on radio. But one of the things that journalists maybe don't realize, and I'm working very hard with my students to explain this, is that we don't just document authority, but by the very nature that you put someone on the air or that you quote them in your story, you have conferred upon that person a certain amount of authority, because then the next librarian, the next journalist who comes along is going to say, oh, well, Abby cited them in the Globe and Mail, so it must be okay. So if you don't get it right, you're the one who first ran them. But worse, if you hedge your bets, or if you're under deadline and you're running really quickly and you use the same people over and over and over again, you promulgate a certain propaganda, a certain status quo approach to reporting the news. And it's important to understand that the people who've always been quoted are not necessarily the only people who should be quoted. And the people who could be found to be, expert witnesses or expert sources for information might not have published or been given a voice in the past. And the interesting and intriguing thing is that with the internet, with the World Wide Web, we are seeing some alternative voices. And some of them, quite frankly, I probably can't say crap over the podcast, but I just did. So some of them are not worth a lot. But some are extremely valuable to you. It takes more time to find them. It's harder to find them. And maybe even harder to track them down and harder to get them to go. There are all kinds of challenges in bringing in alternative voices. But ascribing authority and authenticity in a network digital multimedia world is where we have to be moving if we are going to remain valid, accountable, reliable, credible, and valuable to our clients, to our audience, ultimately. It's what's going to keep us from having to fight these wars that, well, I can just get it on Google or I can just get it through some blog. Presenting diverse perspectives. When you choose who to include, when you give your journalists the names of people who could be on a panel, let's say about public versus private adoption, did you include someone from the LGBT community, for example? Did you include someone who represents children who wish they'd never been adopted? Or, there are many points of view, but if we're always looking for the same people, we'll always bring the same people up. Who gets to be an expert? Again, it's the same sources that we find in the same ways we always find them. So we're privileging the mainstream sources in most cases, and that's a time constraint. We're also privileging mainstream formats, and I just want to talk about that for a second. You all know the search engines really look for text, right? Even the image search engines work off of text. There are some specialized search engines. They're not widely available. They're not widely useful for what we do yet, that let you retrieve on things like, faces, find me this face. But in most cases, it's text. And so by relying on text, on textual indices, on textual search, we are still privileging text as a primary way of finding information, finding resources, finding experts, and also disseminating that information. Well, that's fine, that's well and good, but the younger generation is not necessarily as text-oriented as we have been. And there's some evidence to show that there's a bit of a shift from that. So if we're not telling the stories pictorially as well as textually, we're shortchanging ourselves and our audiences. So new media literacy, and this is kind of the bigger picture. It's not just enough for us to, as librarians, to think about how we ascribe authority, how we measure validity of sources, how we define reliability in formats and sources, but increasingly it falls to our audience to become more literate in this new media economy. And some of that is happening at the K through 12 level, but it's very small. And globally, it's not huge. And in terms of literacy, we still tend to think of literacy as a very passive activity. So I receive a text, I read a text, I define whether or not that text is valuable. But increasingly in the new media economy, new media literacy doesn't just mean the ability to read and understand and define whether or not this is credible, but also to produce material. And our readership are, as they get younger, they're more accustomed to having a hand in the production of their information, of having a hand in the production of their entertainment media as well, as evidenced by sites like YouTube and some of the other sharing video multimedia sites. Am I on script? Okay, good. And I just want to talk, sort of shift gears along those lines, because it's easier now with the web for anyone to have a voice, whether they should or not, and for anyone with a new media literacy to produce material that looks very credible, we get a certain authority blurriness. And so not knowing who to privilege for our authority on something, say, as important as whether weapons of mass destruction existed or ever found. We privilege mainstream sources, typically considered credible sources, and in fact those sources let us down. Whereas alternative voices were said quite the opposite, but they weren't given the same privilege. Webcaster singer Sandy Tom, has anybody been following the Sandy Tom story? Sandy Tom burst on the scene with her hit record, I Want to Be a Punk Rocker with Flowers in My Hair. And this phenom was supposed to be, she was a starving singer-songwriter, webcasting out of her basement, God forbid, to millions of people on the web. It was all a lovingly crafted at home endeavor, and people around the world took her to their hearts. She got a great record deal out of it, and her career took off. And then, and news media around the world reported this rags to riches, lovingly crafted in my basement webcast story of Sandy Tom. But of course, in fact, it was all a PR hack. She had a firm that produced her webcasts to make them look sort of blurry in her basement. So, and I should say the CBC did quite a long interview with her, and at one point the journalist got so close, the reporter asked her, gee, you know, for something sort of done lovingly at home, your camera is very, you know, still, very high quality. And Sandy said, oh, we use duct tape. along similarly surreal lines, Colbert at the White House Correspondents Association dinner roasting President Bush, sort of, you know, very, peep, you know, moment for me. Because, of course, Colbert plays a reporter in his own spin-off show that came out of The Daily Show. Speaking of The Daily Show, you should look at the statistics on how many of your younger demographic prefer to get their news from Jon Stewart. And I myself enjoy watching Jon Stewart, but one could say either it's the entertainment value and we should all just go out and shoot ourselves, or one could say it's one of the only easily available non-mainstream privileged approaches to journalism that's available. So think about that. YouTube, many people crafting their own videos now and putting them up, and in fact, several getting lucrative jobs out of that. And some of what's going up there is news. So people whose neighborhoods are not being covered adequately are going out with small handy cams and shooting the news in their neighborhood. And finally, if I've got time, I just wanted to leave you with a short clip. Have you all seen the Yes Men clip? Show of hands. I won't show it if everybody's seen it. Oh, okay, good. This will be a nice thing to go out on. And I'll just tell you what this is about. Hold on. Let me just end the show for a second. I've got it stashed down here. The Yes Men, and I'll make this microphone kind of close. The Yes Men is a sort of an activist group, and they do sort of guerrilla theater. They spun off of the Critical Arts Ensemble a number of years ago, and I wrote about the Critical Arts Ensemble when I was doing my research in hacktivism. The Yes Men do media hoaxes and cultural jamming, so they do media spoofing essentially. And in this case, they managed to set up a website that made it look like they were Dow Chemical. And they had a website that basically talked about Bhopal and the tragedy in Bhopal, because Dow, of course, bought Union Carbide, and when they did that, they said, we have no intention of making reparations. So anyway, the Yes Men set this website up essentially to sort of educate the public, and a number of people clearly thought that that was actually the Dow Chemical website, and so they would post questions, and so the Yes Men would answer these questions as though they were Dow. And finally, the BBC contacted them for an interview, thinking they were Dow Chemical.
The day of commemoration in Bhopal.
It's not very long. Sorry. There's a microphone there. Yeah. Is that microphone on?
There may be an audio feed off.
That would be important because they were accepting full responsibility for the
book. He goes on. Unfortunately, I should have brought an audio cable. I thought it was going to be loud enough for the animals. But the interesting thing is you can go to yesmen.org, and you too can download this. This aired. I'll just sort of talk over it, but I'll shut it down. You can watch it. So this is on the BBC. It's airing live. He was asked to comment, and he then sort of sprang it on them at the last minute and said, this is such a great coincidence that the BBC is, interviewing me today, because, in fact, today is the day that we're going to announce that we're making reparations. We're going to step up to the plate, and we're going to make full reparations to everybody and all their, and we're going to clean up the mess that we set up. Anyway. So this is on the BBC. The BBC reporter does, ask them some questions, and they go back and forth a bit, and they end on a really positive note. What a great day this is! Corporate responsibility. Woo. Then this story, of course, was immediately picked up and run around the world. It took Dow 2 hours to clue in and issue a retraction and a resounding condemnation, and basically to say, no, we have no intention of making reparations. We're never going to do anything for these people. So in the end, the Yes Men feel that that they're speaking up for people who are whose voices are being marginalized, and they did apologize. In fact, the Yes Men apologized to all the people in Bhopal who had their hopes raised, but they said, your hopes were dashed and dashed again, and if this does anything to enlighten the rest of the world, we think it might be a good thing. And they continue to do this. It's absolutely amazing to me that after this kind of a stunt, they're still getting away with it. And so, in fact, they went to Australia not too long ago. This is the second time, as posing as members of the WTO. And basically saying it was going to be shut down. So I leave you with that, and just want to say that we have real challenges in fact-checking, real challenges in establishing credibility, and I don't deny that. But as you do that, and as the journalists you work with do that, and you support that work, please be aware that you don't want to err on the side, then, of only privileging the mainstream voice. And, whoops, I have one more slide, but I can't get to it. Oh, because I'm not in live. I was just going to say, in terms of keeping current, these will all go up, but I think keeping current is a process. It's not a bunch of resources. I absolutely agree with Paula. Automate what you can, have RSS, have things shipped to you rather than you having to go out and grab them. You know that. I like Research Buzz and Media Post and Pointer and the Online Journalism Review. And the Canadian Journalism Project is a project that we've just started to do for Canada, basically what Pointer does for the United States. We have big goals and no money. And then Delicios, I love that as a way of organizing my stuff. And these associations, I learn more at SLA and ACIST and the Association of Internet Researchers. I learn more over coffee and at dinner and in the bar than I could learn in a weekend surfing on the web. So thank you very much.
But I have to say, if Abby is not well, I can't wait to see what she's like when she's 100%. It's amazing. I was... Yes?
I'd like to introduce the representative from the Dialogue Thompson, Ellen Heather.
Hi. Thank you very much. I don't know about you. I know I have questions. I hope you folks in the audience do, too. If you have a question, I'm going to repeat it once you ask it for the sake of the podcast because we don't have a microphone in the room. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I can't tell you how much I'd like to spend all day researching and making myself a more knowledgeable person. But I also have to be producing my own information that other people can research. So I wondered if you had any recommendations for time management.
And I guess for all three, any of the for everyone.
Hire a graduate student.
The best tool I've found is my ability to go back and find previous stuff. And I mentioned Copernic desktop search. That has absolutely been a lifesaver for me. Because so frequently, a press release will pop on my desk, and I'm trying to coordinate and figure out where I've seen things before, people and products, and gee, that sounds like this other. And I'll thoroughly search my own desk, you know, just to sort through what I already know or have already seen at one point. I go through, as all of you do, I'm sure, a tremendous amount of stuff, and I just can't keep it all sorted up there. Copernic desktop search helps me tremendously.
I'm about the last person on the planet. Ought to be asked about time management, but, and year two of trying to figure out how to get my dissertation done, you know, and carry on with the rest of my life. My brother is a cardiologist, and he's fond of saying that stress is trying to live by somebody else's rules. If you're in a time crunch, somehow you've got to kick it back up the chain and say, I cannot do all this. What, you know, a group of people has to make some decisions about priorities because you can't do it all. That's not really a good answer, but that's the best I can offer. You know, I have students who come to me and say they're weeping in tears, they're exhausted because they're interning and four different editors have asked them to do something. I say, well, stop. You know, you got to find somebody to help you triage this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are institutional decisions and you shouldn't have to carry the burden of it, I think.
And in fact, I didn't repeat that question, but it was about individual time management for the sake of the podcast. Eli? Oh, sorry. I have someone directly in my line. Go ahead. You first.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
I have a very extreme example, and I'm not going to get into all the details, but my question is not how to keep current, but if you, say, step out of the stream, how to get back into the water.
Very good question. Eli was asking, if you... are up to speed and then somehow are out for a day, an hour, a week. How do you get
7 months?
Yeah. How do you get back into the full stream again?
I'd like to address that. My situation is similar in that I needed to get up to speed very quickly in a field that I really hadn't been in for many, many years. I stepped out of journalism and out of working for a news organization when I went to my PhD and did nothing but LIS education, and now I find myself needing to get plugged back in, and not only plugged back into journalism, but plugged into a new country, new laws, new FOI rules, everything. And people are a lot faster resource for my learning than our documents. Yeah, maybe you're a visual learner. I don't know. Maybe you're not. But I think I'm an oral learner. And knowing that about myself, if I can surround myself with people who are talking about the things that I want to know about, and then be humble enough to say, huh, which I am all the time, just let other people, you know. And so a venue like this is extremely worthwhile, but so are smaller ones like taking people to lunch that you know can inform you.
I have a close friend who sort of not kept up with some of the new technologies and whatever, and she managed to come over to the Computers and Libraries in Washington, and afterward was just glowing. She was so excited. I heard Gary Price. I heard Jeannie. I heard this one. I mean, she was so excited about getting up to speed quickly. And I think, as you said, people and networking at conferences, pick out a couple of key events, key sessions, and, you know, go from there.
Sure. I'll echo what Paul and Abby have said. It's similar to the answer I gave before, that it is about networking. It's part of sort of figuring out how to be a group of people and kind of keep each other supported and keep each other informed, which is what you're doing here. You know, this is a low-tech version of the internet, essentially. But this is in fact the engine of discovery and the engine of innovation, the engine of novelty, when people get together and kind of rub shoulders, so to speak, and learn from each other. You know, I'm not surprised to hear that it was in the coffee shop or, you know, that other place where you got most of your learning done.
Abby was just mentioning continuing education, and I can't back Ira up enough in terms of professional conferences. This is invaluable. SLA is invaluable to me, and other professional conferences as well. IRE is very helpful as well. So, the professional conferences are a very good thing, and I'm not on the payroll or anything. Yes. You're the one.
Okay.
You're the one. You're
it's all you. I wanted a question for Abby, but speaking of that, the yes men that you were pointing out, do you know if anyone out there is sort of collecting and cataloging incidents like this? And the reason I ask is because one of my local television news, and I won't say which one, were pumped by local theater students who were posing as like representatives of a national association for a certain, and as to my knowledge, this paper doesn't even, or newspaper doesn't actually know.
Let me just repeat the question. The attendee is asking whether the Yes Men event or other punked type events or hacking type events on to legitimate news are being cataloged in their own way, are somehow being kept track of, and some sort of
help people be aware when they chat.
Right.
I don't know if there are websites that deal with this, but I also know that Patrick Boyle, who is the editor of a publication called Youth Today, and went back after many years to get a master's degree in journalism, did a project that he calls a hoax project. And if my card's up here, and if you send me an email, I will try to figure out if he's put that on the web or not. But it's got a long and storied history. It's not new. In fact, the internet, in some ways, no. But you could sort of say it's worse in the age of the internet. But you could also say I'm not shocked to find out we're finding more about journalist plagiarism, for example, in this era. I don't think there's any more of it. I have no way of knowing this. I think it's much easier to detect.
Yeah.
But it's a very old problem. Yeah, and I have a card up here. I'll find it for you.
If you do a search on media hoax, you'll get a number of websites that have collected them, probably not at the local level. So that'd be a great project. The other thing I was going to say in line with that is that, this whole thing with the BBC and the Yes Men could have been avoided if someone would have done a quick Who Is search on the domain name. Because, in fact, the Yes Men weren't registered through a third party. They weren't registered through a hosting service. They registered in, the only thing that was odd is when they did the WTO hoax, they did register through the name, without permission, of the son of the head of the WTO. And so he was able to shut him down because legally he did have a claim to it, even though they paid for bills. So. But it's one of those tools, though, right, that you want to teach journalism students as well as librarians is how do you find out where this email came from? How do I ping this person? How do I do a Whois lookup? How do I find out who registered this domain name? You know, who's responsible? And those are not surefire one, you know, silver bullet tools by any means. But everybody in this day and age, if they're going to be media literate, they have to be taught those authenticating tools.
Can I also just add something to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that completely. And I think one of the things we teach students and we need to keep learning is this idea of extending the logic of whatever it is and asking yourself, if this is true, what else would I expect to be true? And one thing you would expect to be true is somebody that's in sort of the public domain in a big way has a track record. You know, that and when you search on them and you don't find clips and you don't find anything mm-hmm. going back more than 2 or 3 months, something's not right. You know, and these are kind of heuristics, you know, that you bring to bear. But it's asking that question, what else would I expect to be true if this is true, is very powerful.
So it also means we privilege the same people over and over and over again.
Yeah, I'm not proposing that we privilege the same people over and over again, but that you can go kind of figure them out. There's all kinds of new people to bring in,
yeah.
And so you have to sort of work a balance there.
Yeah, we'll try.
Okay. I was going to ask a question, but I don't want to jump in ahead of anyone else. Ira, the fact that you just had the microphone really brought this question right up. Everyone here spoke of citizen journalism and blogging. Abby particularly spoke of journalists who are both working for McLean's or other papers and blogging. I know that was an issue for us at CNN of several years ago. Someone lost a job over keeping a blog. And I want to know, what are you communicating in the classroom to your budding journalists about how, I know it's not a question of ethics, but how this works to cut both ways, being both a legitimate journalist and being a blogger?
A really good question.
Sorry.
I'm thinking of an answer. I haven't really specifically talked about this in class, but I'll tell you that, and it's something that I'm researching the history of election night forecasting, which is how computers got mixed up with journalism, was through these seemingly kind of hokey looking things that weren't really hokey at all, going back more than 50 years, as a matter of fact. And one of the conclusions I've come to is that whenever a new tool comes along, you know, we think of new tools as a progress, but new tools are also kind of incredibly disruptive. And one of the things they do is cause us to ask questions like, well, what is journalism? And what is a journalist? And what's a journalist good for? And a lot of technologies make us ask, what's a human being good for? You know, honestly, you know, right? Like, so if a computer can do my job, you know, what's up with that? So I think we can't see in real time what's going on, and we can't really see what in 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years from now is going to be defined as journalism. You can't see it in real time. Someone who had looked at the history of was trying to figure out what was going on in the printing press between 1450 and 1500 would have concluded that the church was going to control all printing. It would never have guessed that it was going to sort of go completely the other way around. So I guess my cheap answer to that question is that all the kinds of things that Abby was talking about here, verification, determining authority and authenticity, that, you know, these are all, you know, good journalism and good ethics are you know, they're identical. They should be identical. And that, you know, if you say something, you got to be sure it's true. It goes for the we talk about the news column and the editorial column. The same thing applies. I mean, it's got to be true for you to call it journalism, and you can't go off sort of half-cocked.
Can I just, as a matter of question to that question, do you feel comfortable telling journalism students, and this can apply to any of you or bloggers, do you feel comfortable being able to say to them, you can both be an objective observer of news and you can express your opinion? That alone, in talking about authenticity and who's got the real skinny on something, that tends to split the difference there.
I mean, this is a huge question, and I don't think we're going to resolve it in short order. And it's a historically placed question. I mean, the idea of objectivity, you know, for those of you in journalism know that it's not something that's existed forever and ever in the history of journalism. It's a relatively new idea. And we might find it's a blip on the screen over time. I hope not. You know, I'm sort of old-fashioned that way, and I kind of hope not. I think it is a problem to be sort of expected to be an objective voice and also to be sort of expressing opinion. I don't agree with the definition of objective that says you have to give equal weight to all sides in an argument. That's not objective. That's not only crummy journalism, that's unethical journalism. To sort of give equal weight to something you know isn't true, you could demonstrate it isn't true. But I think we run into problems when we express our opinion and become sort of identified with that opinion. But I can't say that that's not where we're going to end up heading. You know.
In terms of how I'm educating my students right now, I try to remind them that what they think they want to do with their lives today won't necessarily be what they want to do with their lives 20 years from now. But that blog will still be around to haunt them. And they may think that they want to be a columnist like Margaret Wente or something like that. When in fact, 10 or 20 years down the line, they're really going to want to be a political reporter or an investigative reporter. And they're very, non-objective, very biased columnist-like blog is not going to help them get that job. So the other thing, though, that I also tell them is that they should be keeping a blog where they try to write in a fairly reporterly fashion. And that's part of their portfolio now, along with all the other stints they get to do as interns and co-ops. So, for a lot of people, they might get hired as freelance bloggers by one of the mainstream media long before they're given actual column space or airtime.
Another thing to tell those students, the Internet Archive is archiving that stuff.
Yeah.
It will come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
Because you were here as a professional. That's right. Many thanks to everyone in the audience. Thank you to Dialogue for sponsoring this, and thank you so much to our panelists. It was great.
And I'm so sorry for all the comments.
Yes,
I thought I had it nailed.
Oh, wow.
And then
Dan Onstead. You know, are you on the
radio? Hi. Halfway
to my hand, you said, who's it wrong in the library?
In the library.
Anyway,
what barrel on the college part? Oh, this is such a great place.
Yes.
Pretty stunning.
Well, several people are able to talk to me.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, I'm glad to meet you.
Hold on, I'm being
lucky. I have a special class this summer in special libraries.
Well, good for you.
Thanks. I want to take this guy's class. He offers a class at Maryland.
That's what I hear. He's going to do one that's going to be like a journalism for library students.
I would love to be in on this. It's right there.
Hi, Larry. My next class.
Because it's somewhere wrestling with NPR.
Yeah.
Because people, not about the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Start
Chair now.
That was a great panel.
Isn't that fabulous?